It's Encounter on the Voice of America. Encounter on the Voice of America brings together advocates and opponents debating the critical issues of our time in a freewheeling, no-holds-barred discussion of fact and opinion. With today's guests and the topic for Encounter, here is Carol Castiel.
Welcome to Encounter on the Voice of America. On this edition of the program, how the deaths of two black men, one in Ferguson, Missouri, and one in New York City, and the respective grand jury decisions not to indict the police officers involved have triggered a debate about the use of excessive force by local police, as well as racial profiling in America. Hello again, I'm Carol Castiel. 2 weeks ago, a grand jury decision not to indict Officer Darren Wilson in the death of unarmed black teen Michael Brown sparked outrage in major urban centers across the United States. Following the grand jury decision, which many viewed as unjust, violence broke out in and around Ferguson as angered citizens set cars afire and looted a range of stores. However, peaceful protests also occurred in New York, Los Angeles, and Chicago, among other cities. And barely 10 days after the decision in Ferguson, a grand jury in New York City voted not to indict a white police officer in the chokehold death of Eric Garner, an unarmed black man, in July. The decision not to indict Officer Daniel Pantaleo was all the more astonishing because, unlike in the case of Michael Brown, the incident was captured by a pedestrian on his smartphone video recorder. One sees that the 43-year-old Eric Garner was arguing with several New York police officers who were arresting him for allegedly selling loose cigarettes. After several minutes, Officer Pantaleo grabs Garner from behind in a chokehold and forces him to the sidewalk. The heavyset Garner, who had asthma, was heard repeatedly gasping, "I can't breathe." While President Obama reacted swiftly to the grand jury decision in New York, saying it underscores the frustrations many African Americans feel that, quote, law enforcement is not working with them and dealing with them in a fair way, unquote. For many Americans, the grand jury decisions in both Ferguson and New York were just another reminder of the shortcomings of the U.S. criminal justice system and its perceived unequal treatment of citizens of color. In addition, the circumstances surrounding both cases raise questions anew about the makeup, training, and possible use of excessive force by local police departments. In response to nationwide demonstrations calling for police reforms following the fatal shooting of Michael Brown in Ferguson, Missouri, the Obama administration has established a federal task force to look at updating policing policies, including the use of force in detaining suspects. The Justice Department has also launched a civil rights investigation into the incident. U.S. Attorney General Eric Holder announced that he is opening a federal civil rights investigation into the death of Eric Garner as well. Well, for more on the fallout and implications from the grand jury decisions in the Michael Brown and Eric Garner cases, we turn to two distinguished analysts. Sam Fullwood III is a senior fellow at the Center for American Progress, where he analyzes the influence of national politics and domestic policies on communities of color across the United States. Prior to joining the center, Sam was a columnist for the Cleveland Plain Dealer newspaper, and during the 1990s, he was a national correspondent in the Washington Bureau of the Los Angeles Times, where he contributed to the paper's award-winning coverage of the L.A. riots in 1992. And Andrew Ferguson, he's associate professor of law at the University of the District of Columbia. Prior to joining the law faculty, Professor Ferguson worked as a supervising attorney at the Public Defender Service for the District of Columbia. He is the author of Why Jury Duty Matters, A Citizen's Guide to Constitutional Action. And both gentlemen join me here at the VOA Broadcast Center in Washington. Welcome to you both.
Thank you very
much.
Great
to be with you.
Well, gentlemen, let me first begin with Sam Fullwood. Sam, now we have two grand jury decisions which sparked outrage here in the United States. Certainly, there are those on the other side who perhaps believe that the grand jury decisions in both these cases are certainly justified. Look at the two cases. What do they have in common, in your view?
Well, the superficial and overt facts are that you had a white police officer in both cases, and you had an unarmed African-American man as the victim, and they were both killed at the hands of the police. The similarities kind of diverge in the details of exactly what happened. With the case of Mike Brown in Ferguson, the details are murky. because it is only the police officer's word and the eyewitness account of people who were witnesses on the street to that. In the case in New York regarding Eric Gardner, it's a little bit clearer, at least to outside observers, because there was a videotape. I think both of them sparked outrage because of the pattern of police activity across the country is perceived on the part of African Americans as to being unfair to them, that these kinds of things rarely happen to white Americans, but they happen disproportionately to African Americans. They often see this as a pattern, and it harkens back to very, very bad memories of a darker period in our history.
Indeed. Turning to you, Andrew Ferguson, for your take on these two cases, what they have in common, what they don't have in common, and any patterns you see, as Sam Fullwood mentioned.
Well, as a legal matter, they both have in common a very unusual grand jury practice. What we have here is a grand jury that heard far more evidence than would ever be heard in a normal or typical case before a grand jury. In the Ferguson grand jury, that grand jury heard 60 witnesses. They heard all of the medical and forensic evidence. It lasted for 3 months. In a typical case, a grand jury would hear one or two witnesses, sometimes summarize testimony, none of the medical evidence. And unlike most grand juries, the prosecutor in this case did not suggest to the grand jury what charges to bring. In most cases, the prosecutor is in control of the grand jury, and they advise the grand jury where they think the evidence should lie. It's a grand jury's decision, but it's clearly controlled by the prosecutor. That didn't happen here, and it didn't happen very purposefully. This grand jury was given free rein, in part because this prosecutor didn't want to take the political responsibility for the decision. It's a little harder to analyze in New York because we don't quite know what happened in the grand jury. They haven't released the transcript, which is quite unusual, honestly, but they haven't released it. But we do know what happened in Ferguson, and in both cases, there was a lot more evidence. The defendant testified with pretty much no cross-examination, also almost unheard of in a typical criminal case.
Do you see, as implications or as larger questions that these two cases raise, a pattern of police behavior that is at least perceived by African Americans as disproportionately, perhaps, more abusive?
I mean, I think it's clear that there are two injustices here. There is the injustice of unarmed African-American men being killed by police. And then there's the injustice of what happens in the accountability mechanism with the grand jury and why there's a different type of grand jury, why there's a different process in a grand jury when the police are being charged with a crime rather than anyone else, no matter their color, who is charged with a crime.
So basically, when it's a police officer, then somehow they're given some sort of a benefit of the doubt with respect to the grand juries and the prosecutor?
It's almost a wholly different process. The grand jury in America is an institution of citizens who get to make a decision. However, the information they're given comes from the prosecuting authority. Many times, prosecutors simply want to provide just the bare minimum they need to establish the requisite legal standard of probable cause. And usually that's quite easy. In these cases, it was very different. In these cases, the prosecutor provided a tremendous amount of evidence and exculpatory evidence that allowed the grand jury to come to a decision of a no true bill, which means that the case is not going forward toward trial.
Back to you, Sam.
I want to make a point that's very clear, particularly for your listeners who may not be as familiar with our system.
Exactly.
A grand jury does not determine whether the defendant is guilty of a crime or not. What they're attempting to do is to determine whether they should be tried for a crime. And part of the outrage that I think a lot of people across the country, particularly in African-American communities, is that there's a sense that they won't even get to have the trial to determine whether this person was guilty or not.
Absolutely. And that leads me to another issue. President Obama's nominee for Attorney General, because Eric Holder will be resigning, Loretta Lynch, she will be subject, obviously, for confirmation. She was quoted as saying that this is more about decades of, in her view, racial disparity and economic disparity, less so a problem with the police. Would you agree with that, or is it something?
I would not agree with that. I think that it is somewhat of a cop-out to say that this has to do with people being poor or being poorly educated or history of oppression or anything like that. That is a part of our history. I don't want to minimize that part of it. But this is just purely a system where the police seem to be able to play by a different set of legal rules than ordinary citizens and a lack of an accountability for their behavior. And I think that pattern of behavior is historic in the United States. But I think it is particularly acute when you have police, particularly white police, patrolling and policing African-American communities, which makes it sort of a tension, an inherent tension, people not knowing each other, not really respecting each other, and then not being held accountable for their behavior.
Turning to you, Andrew Ferguson, what's your take on some of the issues at play here? Would you agree with Sam Fullwood that this is more about police playing, or at least being perceived to play by a different set of legal rules? And again, particularly in the case of Ferguson, Missouri, you have a predominantly white police force patrolling or overseeing communities of color.
I think those are interrelated points. I think as a factual matter in Ferguson, you had a rather undiverse police force that was patrolling a community of color, and that created its own tension and created a longstanding tension. In fact, one of the positives of this case, if you can think anything as positive, is that there's been some attention about the low-level frustrations, the arrests of citizens of Ferguson for very minor things, but that created this distrust of the police, and that has been exposed, and hopefully some of those issues will be addressed. But in terms of the different standards, there literally are different standards. The law is different in terms of how juries and grand juries evaluate what police officers do. The standard of objective reasonableness of how they respond to authority and how they're given more authority is actually different than it is for other ordinary people. And as such, the law has been created as being rather protective of police, in part due to the difficult job police play, in part due to the risks police take, in part due to the nature of violence in policing. But as a result, when these cases come before a jury and a grand jury is expected to evaluate the law, and in following the law, they tend to give the benefit of the doubt to the police officers. So you do get a different system. It would be radically different if Michael Brown had shot Darren Wilson. The indictment would have taken days, not months. He would have been indicted quickly, and there would certainly have been a trial because the protections given to just an ordinary civilian, especially when it killed a police officer, it would be night and day.
We're going to talk about the police and what is perceived as a militarization of the police force here in this country in just a moment. But first, you're listening to Encounter on the Voice of America. My guests are Sam Fullwood. He's senior fellow at the Center for American Progress, and Andrew Ferguson, from whom you just heard. He's associate professor of law at the University of the District of Columbia. I'm Carol Castiel. We're discussing the outcome and aftermath of the grand jury's decision not to indict police officer Darren Wilson, the white officer who killed an unarmed teen, Michael Brown, in Ferguson, Missouri, earlier this year. This is a reminder that our Encounter podcast is available for free download on iTunes. You can find the download by clicking on the iTunes tab on our website at voanews.com/encounter. You may also follow me on Twitter at Carol Castiel, VOA, and we always love to hear from you. Please connect with us on Facebook or send us an email to encounter@voanews.com. Here's a shout-out to a loyal listener, Shaista Khan Ahmadzai. He's from Afghanistan. Thanks so much for your support. Well, back to you, Sam Fullwood, to talk about the benefit of the doubt or the sort of protections the police officers seem to enjoy vis-a-vis other civilians. Of course, we notice in this country what Obama calls a militarization of local police forces. Many local police forces are receiving all kinds of equipment from the Department of Homeland Security. They're using tanks, using kinds of equipment in policing communities that one would only normally perhaps see in a war zone. To what extent is this a factor in exacerbating these kinds of issues?
One could almost have anticipated the use of these military weapons following the widespread public support for tougher policing and surveillance following the 9/11 attacks in this country. That's where all of this really came from. There was enormous sense of insecurity across the country, primarily directed at foreign terrorists. And many local police forces felt that they needed to have more and new and shiny military hardware, which the federal government saw less need to have because of the way in which they conduct warfare themselves. And so they sold it, or gave it in some cases, to local authorities. Once the local authorities had it, they felt compelled to use it. You saw that in Ferguson, where the armored vehicles and the assault weapons and the rocket launchers and tear gas grenades and all of those kinds of things, which in a tiny suburban community is really like taking a bazooka to try to knock down a gnat. But they had it, and they were going to use it.
Turning to you, Andrew Ferguson, anything to add or subtract to what appears to be this militarization of local police forces, in addition to training of police and perhaps this sense that communities like Ferguson and others, where there seems to be a disproportionate number of white police officers overseeing communities of color, and to what extent this adds to mistrust and, again, trigger-happy police officers or those who don't use as much restraint as perhaps is warranted?
You know, I think there are two distinct but compounding problems that you see in Ferguson. The first is, as you've discussed, a tension between the police, who are predominantly white, and the community, which was, it's not predominantly minority, but there's a good percentage of minorities in Ferguson. But what you see in Darren Wilson's testimony, the officer's testimony, are a lot of tropes that betray an implicit bias, a fear of Michael Brown. He describes this uncontrollable rage. He uses these terms that I think show an implicit bias and a fear of this officer patrolling this particular neighborhood and interacting with people like Michael Brown. And that led to an ordinary injustice, which was the taking of a life, whether you think it's valid or not. A person died when they didn't have to die. And that is a tragedy. But as you bring up, that is compounded when the response to that tragedy is to bring in the tanks and to bring in a militarized response that only supports the idea that too much force is being used. If you want to de-escalate a situation that is centered around excessive force, you don't bring excessive force. And that's what happen. And that's why the pictures of Ferguson are so troubling, probably to the world, where you see parts of America on fire because of response of tanks. And in contrast, in New York earlier this week, there really wasn't the same level of violent protest. There was protest, and there are people who will be taken to the streets for weeks to come, but it was done in a more restrained way and perhaps a more peaceful and respectful way to the traditions of American civil rights protests.
And how do you account for that, the difference in the reaction?
The New York Police Department recognized that it might not serve their interests to crack down. Now, there was certainly a police presence. There were arrests. But it wasn't the same dramatic use of militarization. And that's what was so shocking to all of America.
Absolutely.
To see these tanks rolling in what was otherwise a protest. Now, that said, there was violence, there was looting, there were burning buildings, and you do need to have order. So I think we need to be fair to the police and the law enforcement. But the scene of emphasizing a protest about excessive force by using what is clearly, it seems like, excessive force was just counterproductive.
I think there are a couple of other things that ought to be thrown into the mix on this. One, I want to emphasize this whole notion of lack of trust, which I think is really at the heart of the problem between police and African-American communities. Long-standing, historic, we don't have time to go into all of that. But I do think that when you have police who have deadly force failing to recognize that there is a lack of trust and to behave in a very heavy-handed, sometimes fatal way, you undermine the whole notion of democratic representative government. That is, the police are public servants. They serve at the will of the public that they serve for. It's kind of tautological, but it's really the way it works. And if that public doesn't trust you, A, the police can't do their job very effectively, and you create this contentious situation. Another thing that I think is very true, too, is that the lack of trust goes both ways. I think it was very clear in the Ferguson situation from the testimony of the police officer, Darren Wilson, that he was afraid of his life and that there is this perception on the part of police in communities that they're not welcome, that their lives are in danger. There is a lack of trust and a fear of the people that they are working around. And that sometimes leads to what is kind of a psychological and political response to what's going on. Psychological in the sense that the police feel like they have to defend themselves at every turn. And the political response is that there is support in some of these communities, political support, for heavy-handed policing tactics because they believe that that is necessary to quell these people that they don't really know and trust. And I think we saw some of that at play, particularly immediately after the first round of rioting in Ferguson. Large numbers of people sort of said, yes, that's what the police need to do. It's okay to do these kinds of things. As it went on, it became apparent that this was excessive.
Indeed. Well, in the few minutes we have left, we have to ask the question, where do we go from here, both short and long term? And we note that President Obama is calling for more than $260 million in federal spending for police forces across the country in response to the shooting in Ferguson. He said that the money would pay for about 50,000 body cameras for police to wear to record their interactions with civilians. He said that the funds would also be used to improve police training. So to you, Andrew Ferguson, is this a good start at trying to address the long-term problem? What about these body cameras? You know, how much will that make a difference? And, you know, the other training that hopefully will take place.
It's certainly a start, and it's a good start. As we see with the Eric Garner case, which was caught on video, body cameras don't necessarily make a difference in terms of how a grand jury might view the evidence. The entire death is caught on tape, and a body camera would have shown the same thing without much difference. This is probably more a local problem than a federal problem. And while I commend President Obama for beginning the discussion and leading the discussion, this is local police departments. What is happening in Ferguson, Missouri is a local problem and needs to be addressed locally. One of the other tragic situations that happened in the last few weeks is the shooting of a 12-year-old boy in Cleveland. It has come out that the officer who shot the child had been essentially let go from his prior employment because he was a terrible shot and he would failed the exams and he just wasn't necessarily the high quality. He needed better training to say the least. Making sure the people we entrust with deadly force are well-trained and understand and have the cultural competencies to be able to deal with all types of people is very important and needs to start as a local level with federal help is always beneficial, but unnecessary.
Indeed. And I recall in the case in Cleveland, he said when he was relaying information to some central office that he thought that the child had a toy gun, but that toy gun was not relayed subsequently when a call for more police support.
There was
a
witness who said there's a young man with what looks like a toy gun out there. The rest of it is caught on video where the police arrive in their car, and literally within 2 to 3 seconds, the boy is shot. There's almost no time to back up, to secure the scene, to do things you might do to make sure you are okay before you use deadly force. And it's just a troubling video.
It's very troubling and very upsetting. More of a local problem. So what do you say, Sam Folwood, to the current plan that President Obama has laid out in terms of helping local police forces?
I'm going to be a ditto head with what Andrew Ferguson said. I think that the role for the federal government is pretty limited. The attorney general can conduct independent reviews. I don't think that there's a whole lot of space for the president or the attorney general to say a lot while those reviews are being done for fear of prejudicing the outcomes of those things. In the case of Cleveland, it's just coincidental that the attorney general has stepped into the Cleveland police situation and has now decided that the federal government should have a supervisory role. And that comes in response to an incident that goes back to 2012 when the police shot and killed two people after a car chase through town. The police said that they thought the car was firing at them when in fact the car was actually backfiring and they were trying to get away. I also really do think that it comes down to local politics. Local communities have to be responsible for the police. The citizens who vote, who elect their leaders, have to hold those people accountable for the behavior of the police. That way you get a response that doesn't require the grand jury to be the sole arbiter of how these things go. If you have strong civilian review, if you have strong mayors and city councils and city managers, these kinds of behaviors will not be tolerated in those communities. I think that's the reason that we didn't see an overreaction in New York and other cities, because they sort of were able to see what happened in Ferguson and say, we don't want that happening here.
Indeed. And just quickly before we go, the question about the federal investigation, even if, as you and Andrew say, it's at the local level where changes need to be made, whether it's the way these communities are being policed, the makeup of the police force, the restraint and the use of weapons, where do you think the federal investigations with respect to civil rights charges in both these cases are going to go?
I think there's a lot of political pressure on the federal judiciary to bring those charges as to whether they will have the evidence and feel compelled to do that or not. I'm not sure.
But with respect to the case of Eric Garner, the Attorney General Eric Holder said that they would be opening a federal rights investigation into his death.
Yes, the investigation doesn't necessarily mean that there will be a charge or anything.
Right. But given the outrage over the two grand jury decisions not to indict these police officers, certainly something to somehow placate the outrage.
I think that a lot of damage can be done to our system if it's only placating. And I think that the administration is under a lot of pressure to show that it is doing something in a situation where the federal government has no real authority. It is the mayors, it's the governors, it's the city council people in hundreds, thousands of communities across this country that have to be responsive to people and be responsible for the police in their communities. If that doesn't happen, then we're going to have these kinds of incidents happening all over the country. You'll have people parachuting in to make light or hay out of it. Our media has a role to play in some of this because they have spotlighted these incidents, sometimes for the good, but often for the sake of collecting eyeballs to watch and to turn it into almost a you-are-there kind of movie spectacle. And I think that, as a former journalist, I'm very troubled by the role that sometimes the media is playing in these.
Indeed, they often sensationalize and dramatize in a negative way. Well, the last word to you, Andrew Ferguson, where do you think these federal investigations on civil rights charges will go with respect to both cases and the role for the federal government?
Well, the standards to prove a federal criminal civil rights violation are quite demanding. The government would need to show that the defendant, the officer in this case, acted willfully in depriving a victim of a right secured by the Constitution. That's difficult to show. And my gut as a law professor is that there will not be federal criminal civil rights charges. However, there may be more investigations in terms of the pattern and practice of police conduct, not about this particular shooting, but about the general police practice. That is what's happening across the nation, where the Department of Justice, their civil rights division, is going in to investigate how police are doing it, improves training and improves accountability. And I believe we will see more of those investigations, no matter who's in charge of the Department of Justice, and probably in the localities around Ferguson.
I'm afraid that's all the time we have on this edition of Encounter. I'd like to thank my guests, Sam Fullwood, Senior Fellow at the Center for American Progress, and Andrew Ferguson, Associate Professor of Law at the University of the District of Columbia. Gentlemen, thank you so much for your terrific insights on this important topic.
Happy to be with you.
Thank you.
Thanks to Anna Zalewski for booking our guests. Our engineer was Nashwan Kali. And I'm Carol Castiel. Join me again next week for another Encounter on The Voice of America.
Encounter on The Voice of America. Encounter on The Voice of America brought together advocates and opponents debating the critical issues of our time in a freewheeling, no-holds-barred discussion of fact and opinion. Your host was Carol Castiel. Join us again next week for another Encounter on The Voice of America.